Support for Science Friday comes from R2C Group. R2C Group crafts TV advertising that's as effective and measurable as your digital and search marketing while helping to build your brand. That's right, TV advertising that generates trackable sales. Learn more at craftplusmath.com. Science Friday is supported by A24, presenting Ex Machina, the provocative new sci-fi thriller that has audiences and critics seduced. Manola Dargis of the New York Times calls it a critic's pick, a futuristic shocker about men, the machines they make, and the women they dream up. Peter Travers of Rolling Stone declares, "You've never seen anything like it." Ex Machina, now playing everywhere. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, smiley face, heart donut, will speak emoji. Is it a new language? But first, back in February, President Obama put out his budget for 2016. He included a 10% bump for NASA's Earth Science Program, raised not only the budget to $1.6 billion, but he raised the hopes of a lot of scientists. But this month, the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology passed a bill proposing to cut NASA's Earth science funding. At a budget hearing in March, Senator Ted Cruz, head of the Subcommittee on Space Science and Competitiveness, lectured NASA Administrator Charles Bolden about how he viewed NASA's mission.
But I would suggest that almost any American would agree that the core function of NASA is to explore space.
Are Ted Cruz and the backers of the House bill really that excited about space exploration? Or is this a way to kill Earth science that tackles climate change? Michael Hiltzik is a blogger at the Economy Hub and a business columnist for the LA Times. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. It's good to be here.
You're welcome. J. Marshall Shepard is host of The Weather Geeks on the Weather Channel. He's also director of the Atmospheric Science Program at the University of Georgia in Athens. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me again, Ira.
We asked Senator Cruz to come on and respond, but we have yet to receive a response from him. Michael, take us through what this House bill proposes and takes away.
Sure. Well, what the bill does, basically, and it's an authorization bill, which means they don't have to spend the money, but it really directs NASA how to spend the money it has. It shortchanges what is really one of the traditional purposes, one of the traditional programs within NASA, which is studying the Earth from space, and it puts more money into planetary exploration, which is something that a lot of senators and representatives, particularly those from the South, are very enthusiastic about. But it really does look like a subterfuge to shortchange Earth science, and at the same time look as though the committee is favoring science in general by building up these planetary exploration programs.
Is this because Senator Cruz does not believe in man-made global warming?
Well, I think there's a lot of hostility among all of the Republicans, both in the Senate and in the House, toward climate change research. And I've written and said in the past that I think basically this is an economic position they're taking, but they're dressing it up with the vocabulary of science. What they're really doing is they're trying to protect incumbent fossil fuel industries from the regulations and the costs that really need to be imposed if we are going to fight climate change. And their chosen way of doing that is to cut into research on climate change that establishes what's happening here on Earth, and also trying to undermine the claims that climate change scientists have to real authority about what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Marshall Shepard, you said you couldn't sleep at night after you heard about the budget cuts.
Yeah, Ira, and I'm a 12-year, I worked at NASA for 12 years at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center right there in the D.C. area where you are, and I just cringed. And by the way, I just posted a blog talking about 15 ways that NASA's Earth science benefits you that you don't see, and you can find that on my Twitter site, at DrShepard2013. And the reason I wrote that, Ira, is that there are four things that have become apparent to me in this discussion, and I won't get into the politics and partisan things, but there are four things that I really have come to light for me. One, I don't think people have read the Space Act that created NASA, because if you have read that, it clearly gives NASA a mandate to not only study the solar system in space, but also to study the planet. And there's direct language in the Space Act that says that. Secondly, the NASA Earth Science Program is much broader than climate change, and the reason I wrote that blog is that it is really touching our lives in ways that people feel every day, from weather forecasts to improvements in understanding of agricultural productivity, drought and water supply issues that are going on in California right now. There are programs in NASA that really are very much directly related to those issues. And then thirdly, our education system as a whole in this country, we already know how important STEM is, science, technology, engineering, and math. NASA's Earth Sciences program is really what I consider one of the top resources in the nation for enhancing STEM education in this country, and we would be set back in that regard alone if NASA's Earth Science program comes under harm. So I push back on this notion that kids are only inspired by planets and asteroids. I go into classrooms all the time, and you should see kids' eyes when I talk about volcanoes, tsunamis, and hurricanes.
Yeah. Michael, the backers of the bill also argue that Earth Sciences could be shifted to other agencies like NOAA.
Yes, that is something they say, but of course what they don't say is that they're also doing their best to cut into Earth Science funding at those other agencies, including NOAA. There's a bill that's been passed on the House side that directs NOAA to redirect its funding toward weather research. Well, we know that weather and climate are not the same thing, and if you spend more on weather research, as this bill wants, you are going to be spending less on all these other things like climate. The National Science Foundation is under a tremendous amount of pressure to cut back on things like earth science studies because its funders in Congress keep saying there's not enough evidence on climate change to warrant the NSF putting more grant money into it. So all these other agencies are also being cut back. They're being sliced in their earth science studies. So I think that's a little cynical for these lawmakers to say, well, this can be done by other agencies, when they're actually cutting all those other agencies.
Mm-hmm. Ira, can I have a quick follow-up to that, if I may?
Go ahead, sure.
Yeah, because, you know, I'm intimately familiar with NASA and NOAA as the former president of the American Meteorological Society and have served on advisory boards for both of those agencies. What we have to understand when we hear that argument is agencies have complementary but very different missions. And when we think about any large corporation, there's a part of that company that actually deals more with the sort of operational and service aspects of the business, and then there's a part of that operation that's dealing with the innovation and pushing forward and the R&D. I see NASA as really the R&D part of the government system here, and much of the science knowledge, some of the advanced technologies that, you know, maybe NOAA might not necessarily want to tackle in terms of an investment, but ultimately some of these NASA technologies and science understandings end up, you know, kind of crossing the valley of death, as the National Academy's talked about in the past, and end up benefiting many of these more operational or service-oriented agencies. So it's not an either-or proposition. These agencies work in complement, and it really is imperative that people understand the sort of unique missions of these different agencies.
But you know, politically speaking, I had a discussion about this the other day with somebody who said, you know, you attack NASA because of all the government agencies, all the international agencies, including the UN and other people. People respect NASA the most. There's a track record of the Hubble. They love the Hubble. They love the rovers on Mars, the Voyager missions. So when NASA says something, people actually respect it. They believe if NASA says that global warming and climate change is real, these are coming from the people people really love to listen to. So they, you know, those are the people to attack the most.
Yeah, that's a great point. And again, I try to kind of get beyond the sort of political rancoring, and I know that that's going on. But you know, NASA has a mandate to understand this planet. In an analogy I gave someone the other day, you know, look, if I live in a house and I have a house across the street and they both have a leaky roof, you know, it's probably going to be more likely that I want to understand and try to fix my house that I live in first before I worry about the one across the street. Mm-hmm. And that analogy is used to suggest that, yes, we must study the other planets. Yes, we must go extend beyond the solar system. But Earth is a planet, too, and we don't have a vacation planet to go to for the weekend when we're tired of this one, and this one actually is the one where I argue that we need to understand. And NASA's unique vantage point is really the only way to do it in some cases when we're talking about the oceans, the cryosphere, the ice regions, and other parts of the Earth system.
So what happens now with the bill? Is there any way to resurrect some of that funding?
Well, I think what this action in Congress tells you is that whether or not there's a way to resurrect it, it's going to be very, very difficult for the Obama administration or anybody to get increased funding for earth science out of these committees on both the House and the Senate side. And it's going to be hard enough just to hold the line on what's been appropriated in the past. And that's a very bad sign, because obviously we need more research on these critical issues rather than less.
This is all very depressing for people who, you know, think that we need research that looks downward at the Earth also.
Well, that's right. Well, that's now you're in the sphere of political science, which is another area where Congress has tried to cut National Science Foundation grants. They don't like political science research because it tells you exactly how these sorts of policies come to pass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. And I just remind, you know, the Science Friday listeners are a very savvy audience, and they know this. But, look, I just remind people that iPhones, improved weather prediction that made us see a hard left that Superstorm Sandy was going to take 9 days out, improved heart procedures in the cardiology field. Those things don't pop out of thin air. They come from years and years of research and development. So we're mortgaging the future on science and advancement with cuts to research and development. Yep. Now we can't be short-sighted to understand it. The very things that we enjoy right now came from years of R&D, GPS. And the list goes on and on.
Well, you know, the way I always have been covering this science stuff for 40 years, and when money talks, you know, when the insurance industry talks, people listen. And the insurance industry helped, you know, stop nuclear reactor production after Three Mile Island. And just recently, a few weeks ago, Lloyd's of London, the world's oldest and biggest insurance company, came out and said that global warming is real. And you'd better pay attention to it. And when the insurance industry talks, people are going to listen about this now. How can anybody in Congress say it's not real when Lloyd's of London has come out and talked about it? So
You've even had President Bush's, Treasury Advisor Hank Paulson, I believe it was, has written on this. Yeah. Christy Todd Whitman is very outspoken. Look, I'm on the record many times of saying this is not a left-right issue. This is a human issue. It has been framed as such, but at the end of the day, I think when financial houses start speaking out, and they are, when the national security infrastructure, the Pentagon and others start speaking out and concerned about these issues, and they are. I even served on a National Academies panel that looked at some of these issues for the Navy.
Yeah.
And look, those folks don't plan for hoaxes.
All right, got to go. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us, Marshall. Michael Hiltzik and J. Marshall Shepard, thanks a lot. We have to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about emoji. Stay with us. Did you know you can refinance your student loans, save thousands, and make the whole process incredibly easy to manage? Our podcast sponsor this week, Earnest, has created the first radically flexible refinancing experience that can save you thousands on your student loans and put you back in control of your payment terms. Their product helps customers save an average of more than $12,500, with rates starting as low as 1.9% APR. Earnest never charges any fees, and that means no penalties for paying off your loan quickly, and no charges for origination or changing your terms down the line. You can set your own terms, change your payment amount and date, or even skip a payment, all with a few clicks at meetearnest.com. Earnest can do this because they're a new kind of lender, one that looks at things traditional banks don't, like your potential, to give you the lowest possible rates. Earnest will never pass you off to a third party. Their on-site team is your customer service partner for the life of your loan. It takes less than 2 minutes to find out how much you can save, and they have a special offer for you listeners. You'll get $150 cash back when you refinance through meetearnest.com/Friday. So don't get stuck paying more than you have to. Check out meetearnest.com/Friday to take control and quickly see your personalized rates today.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Do you speak emoji? By that I mean, do you text symbols like skulls, donuts, smiley faces instead of words? If you don't know what I'm talking about, let me give you a little example. In an episode of the Fox show New Girl, the main character Jess and her best friend Cece, they get into a fight. But rather than a war of words, they have a war of, well, emoji.
Cece just texted me a smiley face.
Is that bad?
No, she just texted me the world's first good smiley face. I'm gonna text her a yellow heart. Yellow heart. Will. Thumbs up.
Well, that seems nice.
How dare she? Chinese man, ballerina, apartment building?
What does that mean? What?
Fine. Poop. Turban guy. Granny.
Don't text her poop.
Explosion. Monkey see? You want to play dirty? Fine. Slice of cake. Turtle.
Don't say. Oh.
Double syringe? Double syringe.
Oh, don't get the dreaded double syringe, whatever that means, if you don't speak emoji. You know, it isn't really news that we increasingly communicate by text. We're all sending each other text messages, right? But earlier this month, Instagram reported that now 40% of the text on its photo sharing platform includes emoji. Let me put in a wide-eyed smiley face right there so you know I'm thinking emoji. So how are these tiny pictographs shaping the way we communicate with each other? I mean, how would you feel about getting a double syringe? Joining me now to discuss, with their words, what the rise of emoji means for the future of language online and maybe beyond is Thomas Dimson, a software engineer and a member of the data team at Instagram. He's also the one behind the company's blog posts about emoji usage. Welcome to Science Friday.
Having me.
Thomas, what is a double syringe?
Double syringe is one that I'm actually not familiar with. I think it's not too popular on the Instagram platform.
Okay. Also, Anna Becker is a designer at the Wall Street Journal who worked on their emoji uncovered interactive story. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
And Tyler Sneblin is co-founder and chief analyst at Itabon in San Francisco. He also did his linguistics dissertation on the cousin to emoji, the emoticon. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
So does anybody understand the syringe reference? Do you know, Anna or Tyler? No?
No.
It sounds very bad, though.
There's a heck of a lot of dangerous things emoji, more than one would expect, though. That's all I've got on the double syringe.
I think that part of what's happening there is, right, so it is used for blood draws, it's used for tattoos, it's used for blood brothers. But here, if you look at where it is, it's nestled among other dangerous things, like Anna was saying, where it's right near the bomb, and it's the knife and the gun, and there's the syringe. So I think that this pointy, sharp, bloody thing is, you know, pretty hostile in that context.
Tyler, can an emoji, and that's how we talk about it, it's not a plural, it is a singular and a plural, right? Can emoji be used, considered a standalone language?
No. I would love to be able to say yes, but you know, you don't have children acquiring this from infancy and going and developing rules. We don't have a way of sort of communicating really intricate syntax things that real languages have. So it's really an important expressive resource for us, but it's not a language in and of itself.
Yeah. So if you want to add in a separate expression of something, how you feel, it's really it's like the old emoticon, I guess, but on steroids, right, Anna?
Yeah, I suppose so. Emoticons are different than emoji.
How?
Well, emoticons are faces constructed of different characters you'd find on your keyboard, whereas emoji are symbols that are regulated by Unicode that mean smiling face or woman or man with blonde hair, or their meanings are compressed into the character, the single character.
Mm-hmm. What does it take for an emoji to become an emoji from a design perspective? For example, who would have to approve the introduction of, we don't have an emoji taco or a hot dog?
Is
that amazing? Yet. Who says we should have one, and how does that happen?
It's regulated by the Unicode Consortium. And they meet every quarter or so to talk about updates to the Unicode standard. And emoji are only a really small part of that conversation. Unicode 8.0 is set to be released, I think, in about a month, and there's going to be something like 7,700 new characters, 15 of which are emoji, because the Unicode library of characters includes all of the text symbols that you want to be understood across different platforms, across like any computers or phones or whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Thomas, what changes have we seen in the way people use emoji on Instagram?
It's absolutely crazy to me, the changes we've seen. So there's actually two kind of inflection points that we saw on Instagram. One was the introduction of the iOS emoji keyboard. So previously you would have to do some kind of crazy tricks to actually get emoji into your text. But once that was introduced, the amount of text, and by text I mean comments or captions that contained emoji, quickly shot up past 10% all the way to 20%. And then it declined after the Instagram Android launch to about 15% or so. And that's just because the Android didn't have native support for an emoji keyboard. But once it added it, it actually had another inflection point, and we see it rising and rising and rising. And as of last month, it's actually reached 40% of overall comments and captions containing emoji.
Wow. I guess, Tyler, one of the interesting things about this is that since they're symbols, they go communications across language barriers, right?
That's true to some extent, just as, you know, to some degree you can rely on if you're smiling, you're understandable that you're happy in most places. But you do get these cultural differences, right? We know from all of the Japanese characters, since these sort of started in Japan, we don't probably use them the same way. Like the ogre, the red-faced ogre is the Nabahage, and it has things to do in Japanese culture about lazy people or misbehaving children, and probably most of us in the West don't use it that way, right? We use it to be like angry-faced or fun. Or some other way. Mm-hmm. And so we can communicate with a lot of these things, like, yes, I want an ice cream cone. Yes, this is an airplane flying. But other ones get to take on different meanings depending on their context.
You explained the difference to me when you said that it's a Japanese invention. That would explain why we have sushi emoji but no taco or hot dog.
Well, this is also the interesting thing. Back in when it was first getting discussed, there was a lot of fighting within Unicode about whether to have these emoji. At the same time, so my co-founder, Rob Monroe, was on the consortium, and people were debating about these symbols from Isaac Newton and whether there were two or one, but there was no question they were going to get in. But then these hundreds of emoji that were used by millions of Japanese people currently, that was under discussion about not being put into Unicode. But of course it did, and now it's expanding ever more.
One seeming example of growing use of emoji is the new skin tones that were introduced this year. Do you think Unicode has to be more responsive to demands like this? Or are they very rigid Unicode body?
It seems that they're pretty rigid, and I'm not sure if your co-founder is a member of the consortium, then maybe you've got a better answer. But it seems that they're pretty rigid, and they don't meet all that often. And new Unicode versions are released maybe yearly. So
let me ask Thomas Stimson. Do you know anything more about this?
So actually, it's actually interesting. The skin tone variants are characters in and of themselves. So there's not actual different characters for each skin tone. It's represented by two Unicode characters, where it's, say, a man, and then it's a skin tone variant that would indicate light skin. And when that's rendered, you can see iOS in recent versions will merge those two characters into one and then render a new symbol. So it's actually interesting the way it's worked. Those, as far as I know, those Unicode characters are skin tone variants. They're called Fitzpatrick characters, and they've been around for quite a while. Mm. So it's interesting to see this evolve, where not only emoji, even in the standard, a single emoji can be represented by more than one Unicode code point. There's certain ones that are represented by up to eight.
Mm. Eight?
Eight of them. Wow. Which one is that, do you know?
The kissing emoji that were recently released, they have kissing emoji that feature any combination of sexes, and those are actually represented by let's say it's a man and a man, it's a man, and then it's lips, and then it's a heart, and then it's another man, and it's actually joined together by another Unicode so-called joiner character, and then that's rendered as a single character on iOS. So it's interesting, if you look at it on a different platform, you might actually see that spelled out as if it's a word.
Right. They need fallbacks for that, right? There's instructions on fallbacks for those joining characters.
Yeah. Tyler, is there a kind of grammar to how people use emoji?
There are some very strong patterns. So what happens is that if you have multiple emojis, so most of the time people just use one emoji. That's just typical. But you do get these sequences of them. You rarely get things like the novel Moby Dick translated into emoji. That's pretty far outlier.
I did
but
see
when you do have
Call Me Ishmael. I saw Call Me Ishmael in emoji today, and didn't, I could never translate that.
It's ready. I mean, Anna has a translation for Wall Street Journal headlines on the page that she put together.
I do, indeed.
But the grammar tends to be, if you're going to do multiple things, you're tending to have some sort of face, and you'll put the face first. So that's the major interesting thing, is that you do this stance work. You tell people how to sort of decrypt your message emotionally first. You also observe sort of time linearity, of course, and you also observe many of the emoticons have directionality, right? The car goes to the left, so that means that if you have the poof of air to indicate a fast car, you have to go car, poof of air. You can't go poof of air, car, because then it would just be driving into the poof of air instead of being the exhaust of going fast.
Yes, that's a lesson right there. Do you think that the internet and the social communities being the Wild West place that they are, that people are going to get tired of having to wait for these rigid, you know, passage of emojis, and we might see a demand for, I want my emoji to create it myself and to be able to use it in my text message?
Unless they create a new standard that can ensure cross-compatibility across different operating systems and browsers, then I'm going to say no. I think no.
Why not just a graphics-based one without having to use that kind of standard? I can stick a graphic of an emoji, and there's some new technology that allows to make my own.
You can put pictures and icons in communication already, I suppose. You know, you can send a picture of your dog, and that doesn't make it an emoji. Mm-hmm. But I think that if you're going to talk about it as a set of characters or a language, even, then it necessitates a standardization. And then you would get, you know, issues with if you're sending your emoji that you made up to on your phone to another person's phone, they're not going to get it correctly or things like that.
Thomas, have you seen people try to form words or express more complex ideas by combining emoji on Instagram?
This is something I was trying to look into. It. I didn't really get super far. Certainly people do combine word or emoji just by repeating them. So you'll see most popular is going to be, you know, a laughing cry, but then the most popular sequence is going to be two laughing cries followed by three laughing cries, etc. On Instagram, since we now support emoji hashtags, we've seen some cases where people are using two emoji to kind of indicate some sort of idea. One that comes to mind is, like, say, a horse, and then you might see a poof, which might mean a horse galloping, just due to the directionality of that. And so it's interesting. I mean, it's probably premature to say that words are evolving exactly, but certainly ideas are being expressed by multiple emoji, and I think that's pretty fascinating.
You can I always put my band name at the end of any of our posts on Instagram or Twitter. You can spell my band name in emoji, which I do. It's a little city and a mouse, and my band's name is City Mice. So I didn't even make that up just for this spot either. I've been doing it for months. Phrases are cool.
Tyler, do you think emoji are improving online communication? Do they add to the conversation?
Yeah, I mean, I think even if you just listen to our conversation here, think about all the cues that we're using. We don't even see each other's facial expressions. We're just listening to intonation and pauses and sort of patterns in the vocal track, but we don't have that in tweeting or texting each other. And so this is a really beautiful way to be expressive and sort of help refine what you're intending to communicate. Mm.
Do you all have your go-to emoji? Do you have a go-to emoji that you use more than anything else?
Pass.
Certainly have a go-to emoji. Which is there's this weird emoji that's kind of this man on a desk or on something with some weird kind of expression on his face and then some like very strange like water dots above them. And I love this emoji so much because as far as I can tell, it's absolutely devoid of any meaning whatsoever. Like it absolutely means nothing. And so I send it to people that get extremely frustrated with me because I'm leaving it up to them to interpret what I mean.
Are you talking about the guy who looks like he's doing a push-up?
It's not a guy doing a push-up. It's a guy that almost looks like he's laying on a desk.
But you see, you've illustrated something I'm trying to bring up, which is we don't have a name for the emoji to describe the one you could go right to, right? There's no name next to that that says, I like the guy on a desk who's got his hair going up in fire emoji, that sort of thing. Do you think we'll get to the point where these individual emojis have, and I said it again, emojis, the emoji have names to them?
They do have names, but nobody uses the names necessarily.
Well, you couldn't tell which one he was talking about. What name was that?
Well, I don't know, but Unicode has names for all of them. Actually, there are names. And if you write a bunch of emoji like in a text on your phone and set the computer voice to read it out loud, then it'll say all the names. So,
oh, is that right?
I think so. Or on your computer, you can do that too. If you type out a bunch of stuff in emoji, then make the computer read it to you. It'll tell you the character names.
Well, maybe we'll get that before we have only about a minute to go somewhere and get to hear that. So what's the future here? Are emoji going to get more complex? What do you think, Tyler?
I'm not sure if they're going to get more complex, but I think that we'll keep expanding them, right? So as the world is using them, they will necessarily, I think, expand, right? You already see this with the addition of sort of skin tones, I think, so that people can feel like they can use these. And I think you will start getting tacos and hot dogs in there. There'll be some pushback probably.
Yeah. There's 37 new emoji proposed for Unicode 8.0, which is coming out next month, and taco is one of them. There are 15 that were accepted. We don't know which 15, I don't think.
And there's a movement to get the hot dog in there, too.
And the hot dog is also, there was a most proposed or most requested emoji bucket in Unicode's consideration this time, which I don't know if that's ever happened before.
All right, we've run out of time. I want to thank all of you. Thomas Dimson is software engineer at Instagram. Tyler Sneblin is a chief analyst and founder of Itibon. And Anna Becker is an interactive designer at The Wall Street Journal. Thank you all.
Thank you.
I have a little emoji in my head that I'm trying to say thank you with on bright smile. After the break, a new way to identify you through your microbiome. You know we love talking microbiome. And now we have a way that you might be able to be identified through the unique bacteria in your microbiome. We'll tell you how that's working. Stay with us after the break. Science Friday podcasts are supported by Casper. Looking for a better night's rest? Consider Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses. Casper is revolutionizing the mattress industry by selling direct and passing the savings on to you. Casper mattresses are obsessively engineered with two technologies, latex foam and memory foam, that come together for just the right sink and just the right bounce. And they know that lying on a bed for 4 minutes in a showroom doesn't mean it's the right bed for you. So they offer a 100-day risk-free trial and painless return policy. Casper mattresses are made in America at a fair price. And today you can save an additional $50 by going to casper.com/scifry and entering promo code scifry. That's casper.com/scifry and enter promo code scifry. Casper mattresses for better nights and brighter days. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. When you watch a crime show on TV, right, all those dramas, you always see those crime scene techs dusting for fingerprints or collecting DNA from a little trace of saliva left on the soda can. But new research could point the way to a new identification tool, your microbiome. Now, researchers doing tests have found that a bacteria that live on and in a person can be used to pick out that individual out of a lineup, even up to a year after the samples were taken. The study was published this week in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Joining us now to talk about that work is Eric Franzosa, research fellow at Harvard's School of Public Health in Boston and lead author on that paper. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks. Good to be here.
How does this stack up so far against DNA fingerprinting?
Well, what we find is that the principle is very similar. You can find unique signatures in a person's microbiome and then compare them against a catalog of signatures and figure out if they match. The big differences are we find that the microbiome tends to be not quite as specific as the human genome. The human genome and forensics can get you to within, you know, 1 in a billion type accuracy, whereas the microbiome seems to be unique to about 1 in hundreds of people instead.
So let's talk about how you collect this. You know, with a fingerprint, as I say, you take it off a cup or something, like a saliva too for DNA. How do you go around collecting the microbiome?
Well, in the samples that we had were from a cohort of individuals who provided microbiome samples in order to aid in research on the microbiome. And some of them are similar. They're swab from inside of a person's mouth or on their skin. Stool samples are used to survey the gut microbiome. I don't know how often stool is left at a crime scene, but that's a convenient means for us to survey the gut microbiome, which is one of the more complex and interesting ones to study.
Could you survey if somebody sits on a couch and they touch it with their skin or whatever? Is that
That's
unique enough?
It's an interesting question. I mean, they will leave behind their skin bacteria on sites that they touch and interact with every day. And we also find that people can similarly pick up sequences like that or microbes from their environment. In the work that we were doing, we didn't necessarily have an environmental sample like that to compare against. We were taking them directly from people, but the principle is there that you could do something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we've done stories about people leaving behind their microbiome is wherever they go.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the interesting applications of this is that if someone leaves behind microbiome DNA, perhaps you know their own DNA isn't on that sample, but they've left behind a trace of their microbiome, that you could potentially use that to link the sample back to a particular person.
Our number, 844-724-8255, talking about the use of a microbiome to identify people. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Now, how granular do you have to get in deep into this set of bacteria that you have to actually make the identification?
That's a great question. And when we started out, we thought just the list of bacteria would be enough. We know that there's hundreds of different bacteria that live on in the human body, but that nobody has all of them, such that perhaps if you just listed out the bacteria that we find in a person, that would be a unique code. And what turned out to be the case is that as you start comparing more and more people, it's not too hard to find another person that has the same set of bacterial species as you. So to do this, to find something that was more unique to you among, say, hundreds of people, we have to go down to a higher resolution than species, and we call that strain-level resolution, or looking at individual bacterial strains. And the way that we looked at strains in this work was based on the presence and absence of genes within individual genomes, bacterial genomes. And so with that level of resolution, we can start to tell people apart.
So you go right into the letters, the A, D, M, E. coli, all way down in there?
You can go all the way down to that level of resolution. That's a form of strain-level resolution, down to the single nucleotide, we would say. Mm-hmm. What we were doing is a little bit more coarse based on the presence and absence of genes, and that's just because it's actually a little bit easier to be confident about the presence or absence of a larger thing, like a whole gene, as opposed to a single nucleotide.
You know, when people do fingerprinting, there's a technique for doing, and they take as X number, depending on how accurate or how much data you want to collect from the fingerprint, you take 6, 10, 12, 20 spots on the finger that you look for those loops and swirls. How many spots do you collect in the genome fingerprinting, so to speak?
In human genome fingerprinting or the microbiome?
The microbiome.
We looked for about 7. We were trying to find these sets of 7 features that would uniquely identify a person. And you can sometimes do it in fewer, maybe just 2 or 3. But if you have a really small code and you're only looking for a couple of things, it's a little bit easier then for that to match somebody new that you've never seen before, because you're only looking for a couple of things. But if you get too big, if you start looking for, say, 100 features, then if any of them disappears over time, if any of them is unstable, then that code is no longer going to match. So you're trying to find some balance between being specific enough to not match people at random, but not so large that you just can't possibly be stable over time.
Can I change my microbial community? Let's say if I want to disguise myself, could I take a bunch of antibiotics to kill some and then eat some probiotic yogurt to put some more back, even have a fecal transplant if I'm going to the extreme?
It's a really good question. We had a handful of individuals in our study who had taken antibiotics for random reasons during the course of the study, and we didn't see a lot of disruption of their codes relative to other people, but it was a pretty small set. These were fairly healthy individuals to start with, and so they didn't have a lot of antibiotic use there. I think the principle is certainly true, that you have more power to disrupt your microbiome than you do, say, your own genome. But at the same time, the microbiome is also, I think, more robust than a lot of people expected. And when you take a shower, you disrupt it, but then it tends to come back. Same for brushing your teeth and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I think the possibility is there to alter it over time, but it probably takes some work.
You know, we're learning that just about every living thing has a microbiome in nature, right? You know, people,
yes.
Animals, soil, water, probably. I mean, can you identify unique soil, water, other or places doing this also?
Yes, and I think that's a really exciting next direction for the work. You know, humans can be identified both based on their own genome and their microbiome, but you have sites that have microbiomes that don't have their own genome, and like some of the ones you mentioned, like a soil sample or a water sample, or even the built environment is a new sort of hot area in microbiome research of understanding the microbial communities that live in public transportation systems or in hospitals and so forth. And so I think, you know, something we would like to now do is take this technology or this method and apply it to these other microbiomes outside of the human body and see if they can be identified in the same way.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Are there big regional variations, let's call them, or environmental variations in these microbiomes that you could say, I can tell that this person has clearly lived in China or in Cuba or in New York or someplace like that?
That's a good question. I don't know to what extent we can see it just around, say, the United States, but in data I've looked at for, say, American populations versus Southeast Asia, you do see signatures of the local diet, especially in the gut microbiota. And I think, if I'm remembering correctly, that in some Korean metagenomes we looked at, there are signatures of or kelp or seaweed-associated bacteria there because it's a bigger part of the diet. So there are definitely signatures of large-scale geography in the human microbiome.
So when you're doing an autopsy, then, you might look for that kind of thing now.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, the same way that I think people have looked at pollen and other small particles in the past to try to trace an individual or figure out where they've been. In the future, this sort of regional specific microbiome signature may add to that kind of investigation.
Some callers. Let's go to Angela in Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, Angela. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. How are you doing?
Hi there.
My question is about the use of hand sanitizer and the hand microbiome. I wondered how that would affect someone's biome and would, you know, putting hand sanitizer on your hands affect what you left at the scene?
It's a good question. I mean, sort of in the same vein as the antibiotics, if you use something that is antimicrobial, you're going to disrupt the signature there. What we often see on the skin is that people tend to reacquire the microbiome that they normally would have on their skin to begin with, even after you knock it out. Because not only is your hand covered in your microbiome, but surfaces around your home are covered in that same microbiome. So if you wash your hands, you'll tend to repopulate your hands with your own microbiome afterward.
Thank you, Angela. Have a good weekend. What would you like to know? What do you still need to know? What are the big question marks to answer about this?
I think people are really excited, myself included, to understand the practical implications of this sort of variation in the microbiome. We know and we've shown that it can be used for identification, but why should a person who's not committing a crime potentially care about why their microbiome is different compared to another person's? In the same way that people are now really excited about looking at their own genomes and SNPs, right, say, in their genome that predispose them to a disease, I think that same kind of personalized health care and health diagnostic could eventually come to the microbiome once we understand those associations.
Well, Eric, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
You're quite welcome. This was fun.
Yeah. Eric Franzosa, research fellow in the Department of Biostatistics at Harvard's Chan School of Public Health in Boston. Scientists have long said that modern-day birds' ancient ancestors were dinosaurs. Paleontologists seem to be digging up a new fossil every few months that confirm this theory. Fossils are good evidence, but how can scientists be sure genetically? That was the question my next guest and his team tackled when they reverse-engineered the beak of an embryonic chicken embryo to create a dino snout. Their results were published in the journal Evolution. Bart Unger-Bowler is a postdoctoral scholar at the University of Chicago and an assistant professor of geology at Yale, and he joins us from the Yale campus there. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira.
You could have picked any body part of the chicken. Why did you choose the beak?
Well, yes, the beak. We chose, and by the way, when I say we, I'm not using the royal we. I really do want to emphasize this was a team effort, and especially between me and my former doctoral advisor, Arhad Obsanov at Harvard. Okay. So I'm just going to go through here. The beak is one of the most distinctive features of the bird's skull. When you look at the skull, we're interested in sort of the really major transformations that occurred deep in the history of life. And the bird body itself is so well adapted for flight. And the head also is sort of adapted for a lot of sensory features involved in flying. And the one feature that seems to vary a lot in this enormous ecological diversity that birds have, like in Darwin's finches, is the beak. It seems to be a very special organ and very unique. Huh.
So you were able to take a chicken embryo and turn it into sort of the snout of a dinosaur? Is that what oversimplification?
We were able to take a chicken embryo and turn, yes, a part of the snout partially into a more, I suppose, dinosaurian or non-avian dinosaurian condition.
Wow. Were you surprised you could do that?
We did this in a way that was informed by comparative analysis of gene expression in other reptiles. So I went down and I collected alligator eggs in Louisiana. I got a turtle embryo from the back of some freezer somewhere. Who knows where that came from? And emu eggs from an emu farm in Gill, Massachusetts. And so we were first informed by the molecular differences we saw between the non-bird reptiles and the birds, and then went in and delved into experimentally altering the embryonic development back into this sort of ancestral form that we had discovered.
So we
were excited, but we weren't that surprised.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flatow, talking about this unique. So how hard was it to do this? And, you know, why could you have let the chicken come out of the egg and develop with the new kind of beak on it?
Well, it's been 7 years, so it wasn't simple. And we still were looking only at the protein and gene expression level. So we haven't yet, although we're working on it, we haven't yet gotten back to the actual genomic sequences that control these changes. But I think we were able to convincingly resurrect ancestral morphology. We did not hatch the chickens because our evolutionary question was answered before they hatched. The skeleton was already sort of formed at that time. But the modifications were fairly subtle, just to the end of the snout. So given the proper reason to do so, I think the animals could have hatched and probably done okay.
Would you have called this a chickenosaur or something like that?
I would not call it a chickenosaur, in part because, well, we didn't alter the genome itself back. So if this animal were to reproduce, it would produce normal chicken offspring. It wouldn't breed true. And also, this is just one step. It's the first step. It's an exciting step, but it's just one part of an animal.
So tell us what it tells you about the evolution from dinosaur to bird.
Yeah. So to us, in part at least, that's the very interesting part. And what it tells us is that this very kind of simple set of genes, we didn't look at all of the genes. Undoubtedly, there are more. But there is a sort of uniquely bird patch of molecular activity in the middle of the face that is not there in the non-avian reptiles. And it's this big middle patch that superficially kind of resembles the big middle structure that birds have, that's the beak. And so when I experimentally inhibited that patch of molecular activity, what happened was the embryos developed a skeleton that looked like more like a non-avian reptile or a dinosaur skeleton, which is that instead of having one big single middle bone forming the beak, there are two small paired ones, which is what we have as babies, what dogs have, and what reptiles have, what other vertebrates have. It was not a bird-like condition. But also, interestingly, it wasn't just that upper bone of the beak that transformed. It was also parts of the bones of the roof of the mouth or the palate, which weren't known to be very closely linked to the snout development. And so we also found this interesting molecular link that showed that two apparently different evolutionary changes were perhaps caused by the same molecular transformation, and a pretty simple and early one at that. So it tells us something about the dynamics of evolution.
Fascinating. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Good luck on your further research.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, Bart Arjiballer is a postdoctoral scholar at the University of Chicago, assistant professor of geology at Yale. And you can see a picture of this chicken dino snout on our website at sciencefriday.com/chickenbeak. That's all the time we have for today. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to the production partners right here of our studios at the City University of New York. Also want to remind you that we've got all kinds of great stuff up on our website at sciencefriday.com, all kinds of our science club. Yes, our science club is asking you to join in our latest project, Explain the Sun. We want your explanation. So head over to sciencefriday.com/science club and find out how to join in our latest challenge to explain the sun.